On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Evers signed legislation last week addressing use of force by law enforcement officers, but he said the bills don't go far enough. Here is Evers last August calling for a special session after the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha.
We know racism and the racial disparities in our state can't be solved by any single bill or package of bills. This can only be the first step.
What is the next step? Has policing changed in Wisconsin? What do you think of the ban on chokeholds and the amendment to the language? 800-642-1234. Sheila Stubbs is a Democratic state representative from Madison. She heads the Legislative Black Caucus and co-chaired the Speaker's Task Force on Racial Disparities. Representative Stubbs, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Morning, and thank you so much, Kate. Thank you for the invitation.
You know, as you are well aware, former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was sentenced Friday to 22 and a half years for murdering George Floyd. What have you been reflecting on as the sentencing came down?
Thank you so much for that question. You know, I think that it was an important day and an important decision that was made. And as we know, no sentence will bring back Mr. Floyd, who should be living with us right now. But I think what that sentencing did was show that, you know, Mr. Chauvin was not above the law. And when I think about what happens, it shows that bad officers will end up in prison, and not just for a little amount of time, but 22 and a half years is a long time to sit. But I think it's an awareness for any other officers who decide to conduct themselves in a mannerism that he did. And I think, again, it's a victory, you know, for the Floyd family. But again, Mr. Floyd should be living with us right now.
Let's direct our attention now to Wisconsin policing bills. And one bill signed by the governor prohibits police from authorizing chokeholds except in life or death situations or self-defense. Why are departments still allowing chokeholds?
Thank you for that question. I think it is one of the most important pieces of legislation. But let's just be clear that, you know, the work of the task force has been unprecedented, and it's groundbreaking in Wisconsin, has now real policies implemented that truly invest in training, promotes accountability, and prioritizes transparency. When task force members that was comprised of law enforcement, faith-based community, and community leaders all came together, it was critical that we hold law enforcement accountable. It was so important that when these conversations occurred within the task force meetings, that we had a training taught by, at the time, Professor Barrett. Now he's Dane County first African-American sheriff, which is so awesome. He explained to us, along with other law enforcement partners there, that if you take that tool away from them, that's one less tool in their toolbox. So then it would just be deadly force. There was not one community member who wanted to see more excessive use of force or wanted to see more deadly force. So it was a moment that you saw community really listen to law enforcement and said, only use it in the case of life and death with this chokehold. And so that's why you saw it as I won't say it's a hybrid model, but it's not just prohibiting chokeholds, but it's in life and death, and it stops the airflow at that moment. It's also important for me to share with you and other listeners that the chokehold is not trained because it's a deadly use of force. And so that's the other part of that conversation. You know, when I started this work, I was 100% let's prohibit the chokehold. But what I will say to you is I listened to the group that was made up of law enforcement and faith-based members and other community leaders. And this is the decision that they made. And this is the decision that I decided to move forward with the recommendation.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about policing with Democratic State Representative Sheila Stubbs of Madison. Governor Evers has signed legislation last week limiting chokeholds, and he signed other policing bills. You can join in. What issues do you think lawmakers should be addressing with policing? What changes would you like to see made in how police officers use force? Should chokeholds be banned? 800-642-1234. Representative, Republicans in the Assembly, they amended a bill to remove language that would have required officers to intervene if they observe unreasonable use of force. What do you make of that amendment?
Well, thank you so much for that question. I want all the listeners to know that when we met for 7.5 months, the use of force definition is one of those conversations that continue to linger for that amount of time. And at the end of our meeting, we thought we would have a definition. Well, it did not happen. So my co-chair, Representative Steinick, who I'm so honored that I've had the awesome opportunity to work with, he said, you know what? We cannot come to consensus. Let's continue to work for. So an additional 3 weeks, continue where I specifically chaired that committee. Let me share with you, Kate, it was a very robust conversation. Now, I want you to think about what we were dealing with as a task force. The Breonna Taylor law happened and the case happened with judgment. We had the Jacob Blake case right here in Wisconsin have verdict and take place. And then 1 hour before the shaving case happened with the George Floyd, that's when we concluded our work. So it was very tense work, trying to build consensus, trying to build trust in that room. And when we walked away, that is what the community decided to say, that an officer should also be held accountable if they fail to intervene. So the duty to intervene language is still there. But the language that we walked out of that room with said, you should review something. So if you as an officer saw something happen, and it's not with the body camera, it is with your verbal eyes. And, you know, from the reports and let's say community or others witness it, if you did not see something, that's the part of the use of force language that we had to have an amendment with. I stood up against that amendment, and it's only because Milwaukee Police Association is the partner who had a problem with the definition. But they had a seat at the table, Kate. Mm. They were involved for 7.5 months, and they decided not to have their representative continue. I think it's extremely unfair to allow others work an additional 3 weeks, and then because the language isn't what you want, within the 11th hour, I'm talking about, Kate, within 24 hours of being on, it was on the calendar for the Assembly, Milwaukee Police Association has an issue. They had a litany of issues. And I stood up very strong to say I could not support this amendment, but I did support the overall idea of a statewide definition. But it was just that this is not how we do business. This is not what I've agreed to. And it has always been, you know, my decision to stand up for the task force. And that's what that action was about. That's the only time myself and Co-Chair Steinicke were on opposite ends, but he understood why I took it more personal. I spent the extra time, Kate, to develop the definition, and it's not fair that one partner gets what they want, and they have to be taught a lesson. So myself and every Democrat voted against the amendment for use of force definition.
Let's bring in a call now. Rosa is joining us from Waterford. Hi, Rosa. What would you like to say about chokeholds? Hi, Rosa. Can you hear us? Oh, I think Rosa is not there. So I want to ask you, you know, data. Data is another big area that it seems as if the task force and the governor certainly agree on. A bill signed by the governor requires the Justice Department to compile information about police use of force. How would having this data help?
Absolutely. You know, I am one who is very data-driven, and I think it's important that everyone gets a chance to see the big picture. So you cannot measure what you cannot manage, right? And so it was important where African-Americans or people of color could say, we feel that law enforcement is excessively policing our communities. But we may have a white counterpart who doesn't feel the same way. Once we get the transparency, once we hold the highest officer across the state of Wisconsin accountable for making sure every municipality collects it, that is the right direction to go. So Attorney General Call, who's in the position right now, is the highest elected official in the state of Wisconsin for law enforcement. So it's critical that we collect the data so we can begin to address the underlying root causes or the issues why policing is being excessive in communities of color. I heard that very loud and clear during our discussion. And it was also important that the transparency happened so community can see how many use of force incidents was occurring and what does the data trends look like.
We have State Representative Sheila Stubbs reflecting on the policing legislation signed by the governor. What comes next in her work on use of force and law enforcement accountability? What does building trust in the criminal justice system mean to you? How do you feel about policing in your community? What actions do you want from elected leaders in addressing police brutality, in addressing systemic racism? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Representative Sheila Stubbs of Madison on the line. She co-led the Assembly's bipartisan task force on racial disparities that produced a set of policing bills. The governor signed some of the legislation into law last week, but acknowledged that more work needs to be done. We need to rethink how police do their jobs. Where do we begin? What uniform practices should Wisconsin mandate? 800-642-1234. Representative Stubbs is with us for about nine more minutes. Now let's go back to Rosa in Waterford. Hi, Rosa. Can you hear us?
Yes. Good morning. Sorry about that. I think I passed the cell tower that cut my phone connection off. Anyway,
no problem.
So basically, the chokehold's been around for a long time. I think what needs to be looked at is the police officer doesn't know if a person is high on fentanyl or any type of drug, and thus doesn't obey police orders when they come to get in the backseat of a car. So after 20 minutes of fighting, it escalates. So I think with chokehold, or if a criminal dies, I think that what should be looked at seriously is, was this person high on drugs? Which could cause death in many, many cases. That's why he kept saying, I can't breathe, even before the chokehold was administered.
Thank you, Rosa. Representative Stubbs.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Rosa, for your comment. It's important to know that the work for the task force has yet to continue. So there were a litany of recommendations. We had 18, and many of the proposals have not been signed into law yet, and there are still several bills that are moving through the legislative process, and these bills currently are on the Senate side. One of the bills in which you're talking about that's important is mandating drug testing of officers after a critical incident. That's Assembly Bill 334, which is a critical bill that every task force member thought was critical, and so that we make sure it becomes law. And I agree with you 100%. We need that drug testing. We need to know if an officer, is not well enough to be even policing on our streets. And if they have been using drugs, then they need to be held accountable. So I want to let you know, and many, many of the viewers, that there are four bills that's already passed through the Assembly, but there are still, over eight bills working through that process. And I just want to let you know that, holding officers accountable is what the task force has been working on the whole time. Transparency, accountability, and training have been the three components that all task force members have worked from in order to come up with the 18 recommendations.
And I think Rosa was referring to that the person in custody should be drug tested when a chokehold is used and it leads to death.
Okay, well, we don't have a bill that way, but I mean, I'm sure, and I'm not going to say 100% that I know what I'm talking about, but I think that probably the law enforcement entity of death was involved. Probably we would want to know if that person was, under the influence of drugs or alcohol. just to build their case through the district attorney. So I think because district attorneys are involved or attorney generals, I feel that there probably is a concept in which they're going to want to follow through the strict guidelines. But that's why I think transparency has to be one of those areas that we still have to dive through in that process. And I want to be clear with you, Kate, and the rest of your listeners, that these are bills are not the only bills that we think are going to, you know, properly address, but it's a start. It's a step. It's a foundation. It's the floor of the entire criminal justice system. But I do think there's still so much work that needs to be done.
I want to get your take on State Senator Lena Taylor, who has a bill that would outlaw no-knock warrants and require all search warrants to be done between 6 in the morning and 10 at night. And your task force, it came to the conclusion that it didn't have enough information about the use of no-knock warrants to recommend banning them. So where are you at personally? What do you think of Taylor's proposal?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that personally, because the way things worked within the task force, it was based on consensus. So myself and Representative Sonny Key, we didn't vote, but we were the facilitators of getting the information. I want to be clear that I did sign on the Breonna Taylor law for the state of Wisconsin. As you know, there were 9 bills that the Wisconsin Legislative Black Caucus, along with Governor Evers and Lieutenant Governor Barnes, started with, that we were saying here are common sense bills that we shouldn't even have to debate. They should just be law. So I've always signed on to the Breonna Taylor for the no-knock warrant. Also, I want to make sure that you and listeners know that Tamika Mallory, who is a national activist, actually Skyped in to our meeting on no-knock warrants. And like I said, it was a lot of information to consume, but I've always, you know, personally been supportive of prohibiting no-knock warrants. I think they're extremely dangerous, not just for officers, but also for community. But we did hear law enforcement talk a little bit about that most of the time they're executing them because of a drug warrant, because there's a really bad person in the community. But again, it's extremely dangerous. And so I like the time frames of making sure no-knock warrants are done at night. I've been supportive of that legislation to sign on to the bill that Senator Taylor has authored, and the lead from the Assembly is Representative Lakeisha Myers. I did sign on to that bill, but that is not one of the recommendations that came out through this task force.
We're talking about policing with Democratic State Representative Sheila Stubbs of Madison. Let's go to Russ now in Pleasant Springs. Hi, Russ. What is on your mind about policing?
I would like to know why Representative Stubbs and all the other community organizations are constantly beating down on the police for doing their job, and the other community organizations are beating down on the police. What if they didn't have any police? And how come there's never any mention of holding the criminals responsible for what they do? Why do the police show up? Because of crimes being committed.
Representative Stubbs.
Yes, thank you so much, Russ, for that comment. I don't think I've ever displayed myself as someone who beats down law enforcement. In fact, I've been a community activist well over, you know, 40 plus years. In fact, I've advocated for my neighborhood officer who started out to be Chief Ray, and at the time he was a beat officer. These bills are not about beating down police officers. These bills are about training, accountability, and transparency. And these recommendations are made up of faith-based leaders, community leaders, and law enforcement. You know, I know that criminals have to be held accountable. I'm a former probation and parole agent of 8 years. So I've been in a system that has held people accountable to the extent of prison. This is about building trust. We have lost trust in communities between law enforcement and community. And so I think our task force makeup was just a start to begin to build trust. Again, I want to be very clear. We had representatives on the task force, that Representative Chief Association, or the Deputy Chief Association, or Badger Sheriff, a Milwaukee Police Association. We had professors. We had actual former law enforcement officers in the room. The Black Police Association was in that room with community faith-based leaders, which were pastors and community activists, all coming together with two law enforcement, with two elected officials that were Democrat and Republican, trying to begin to appreciate this process, but began to really address some of the key elements. So,
and Representative,
I don't ever see myself against that.
And we're short on time, only a few seconds left. But what is the next step for policymaking on policing?
I appreciate your comment. So, again, there are other bills that are working through the process, and these bills will include improving transparency and promoting accountability and investing to better training of our officers. If these other eight bills get through the process and they all pass assembly, then we're moving through the legislative process to the Senate side. Here's the bottom line. The work of the task force has been extremely successful, but it's not the end here. Wisconsin needs to consider this kind of bipartisan work and continue to fight for reforms that make our communities more equitable. Thank you so much, Kate, for giving me this chance.
Thank you for joining us.
Have a good day.
You too. Sheila Stubbs, Democratic State Representative from Madison, co-chaired the Speaker's Task Force on Racial Disparities. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with Jill Underle, Superintendent-Elect of Public Instruction for Wisconsin. News update is next on the Ideas Network. Hi, it's Kate Archer-Kent. Just a quick heads up on our programming. We're preparing to hear from the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis tomorrow, Neil Kashkari. We want to collect your questions for the Fed president on the economic recovery, on interest rates. Leave your question at this number, 833-424-3327. That number again is 833-424-3327. Be sure to mention your name and city, and thanks so much. Now the State Capitol Report continues with a look at education funding. Governor Evers proposed boosting funding for K-12 schools by $1.6 billion over the next 2 years, but Republicans in the legislature, they shrunk that to $128 million in their budget blueprint. There's been some maneuvering of hundreds of millions of dollars to unlock federal COVID funds for schools. Do you think they trimmed Evers' education budget too much, or are schools overfunded? 800-642-1234 to join in. Jill Underle is superintendent-elect of public instruction for Wisconsin. She was elected in April and will take office a week from today. Jill Underle, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. I'm really happy to be here today.
So what is your reaction to these two very different spending plans for education?
Right. I was very excited initially when Governor Evers had proposed his budget for education, because it was a pre-pandemic budget. It was what our schools needed, not only before the pandemic, but also to recover from it. And then, of course, when the JFC cut everything, my reaction to that is that their budget simply does not meet the needs of students and families across the state.
In what way? In what way does Joint Finance Committee not meet the needs of families of children?
Sure. Well, $128 million doesn't get the job done. I mean, we have so many needs when you look at mental health, when you look at special education reimbursement costs, we look at teacher recruitment and retention. I mean, we're losing professionals. If we're going to recover, we have to look at getting the resources to the school so it can get to the kids. And this budget, puts money into property tax release, which does not go into the classroom.
And Republicans have said, look, because schools can tap into $2.4 billion in federal funding over the next 4 years, a larger increase in state funding, it isn't necessary. Do they have a point?
No, I don't think they do have a point, because what they're doing is they're taking the federal dollars that were intended to be on top of what the state obliges to, public education, because that money was intended for pandemic relief and to be the game changer, to invest in early childhood programming, invest in mental health, invest in the things that we know work. And so what they're using is they're using that as an excuse to not invest in our state, not meet their obligation.
You wrote a column that the funding available now could offer a once-in-a-generation game changer for our public schools. What is your vision? What do you see?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a huge opportunity. And when you look at the surplus, you know, we have what, a $6.5 billion surplus here right now in the state. What we were asking for and what the governor had proposed was just, well, before we even knew we had the surplus, but using 1/5 of that, not much when you think about the, you know, the billions of dollars available and what that could be, what we could use that for is really look at our highest need schools with the highest need kids, looking at special education reimbursement, looking at the shortage of early childhood programs and childcare, looking at where we could recruit more teachers, investing in our teachers. I mean, all of that really translates to opportunities for kids, and we need to close those gaps.
When you say close those gaps, the gaps that exist between students of color and white students is very wide, very concerning. How can schools make the most of the funding so that they can close the education gap?
Yeah, I know it's public education. It really needs to be, and it traditionally has been that great equalizer. I mean, it's why our founding fathers put it in our state constitution. It's why we have land grant systems in universities, why K-12 is compulsory. It shouldn't matter where you live, who your parents are, how much money you have. You're guaranteed to get a high quality public education with the best teachers, the best materials, resources, and buildings. And that's what builds opportunities. And so when we look at getting kids a strong start, we need to look at early childhood programming. We have to ensure that it doesn't matter where you live, it doesn't matter how much money your parents make, but you're going to get an excellent start. And that's what pays dividends. I mean, there's research that shows that when we invest early in kids, the payback is 5 times the amount, you know, throughout the rest of their lives. When you look at healthcare, when you look at crime and the juvenile justice system, I mean, there's so many ways that it pays us back, multiple ways.
Have you had conversations with Republican lawmakers about the budget? What are they saying to you?
Well, I have had a couple of conversations with different legislators. I've not actually received any response from anybody on the JFC. And what I'm hearing is that they are not hearing from their constituents, which is hard for me to believe because a lot of people I know, you know, superintendents, parents, advocates, they have been really trying to make themselves heard. I know people went to the budget hearings all over the state and there is so many comments about how we need to invest in our schools. And you look at the past year and a half since the pandemic began and the things that our schools have been doing for our kids and our communities. I mean, our staff have been bending over backwards, you know, make sure kids are fed, to make sure kids are still learning, making sure that we have technology in their hands, you know, just all these different things. And I feel like, you know, when I hear from superintendents, they just feel like it's been a big slap in the face.
Jill Enderle is superintendent-elect of public instruction for Wisconsin. Will take office next week, and you can join in. What do you see as the biggest needs facing Wisconsin schools? Should Wisconsin's unexpected increase in tax revenue go toward public services like schools? Join in at 800-642-1234. Steve is joining us from Sun Prairie with a question on voucher programs. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. You know, one of the things, there's a lot of parents that are calling their representatives right now, so I wanted to correct your guest. I know I call constantly. We are very disappointed with how the schools reacted during the pandemic. You know, we talk about the Constitution promising a great education and in-person education, and we had these schools shut down, provide an inferior education to kids by hiding behind senior citizens, saying that we need to protect them. Then the moment the shot became available, jumped in front of those same seniors. So we would love to see some of the money allow some of these poor people, middle-class people, but afford to send their kids to schools that actually care about their families and about their education.
So Steve is certainly opposed to the virtual learning method that was installed in so many schools in the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. I also want to just kind of clarify one of the points he made. I know people have been trying to reach their legislators. It's just that there's been different legislators who have said that they are not hearing from people. And so I feel that, you know, people are trying really to, you know, trying to make sure that their voices are heard. And I trust that that's what they're doing. So, you know, to address Steve's point, however, about schools having to close and go virtual, I think we have to put this in context. When you look at the fact that this has never happened before, right? We've never had a public health crisis like this in our lifetime. We've never had to really evaluate, you know, our health and our safety in going into our schools. And when we look at opportunities and we look at differences between school districts, what we will learn is that the school districts that are better off, you know, financially, maybe they have newer buildings, maybe they are not as crowded, they were able to be face to face. I also want to, you know, share that I don't know of a single teacher or school district that doesn't care about their kids. But there's a lot of factors that are in play when it comes down to keeping people safe. And I know that we tried our hardest to make sure that we were reaching all kids. And virtually, I mean, that's a new game. None of us, I think, were trained in that kind of delivery model when we were going through our teacher education programs. But I would like to give kudos to our teachers who were able to turn on a dime and make it happen to the best of their ability. And it got better. You know, I'm not saying it was perfect, but it got better. You know, April of 2020 looked a lot different than April of 2021.
You know, some scientists are saying that if vaccination rates don't improve, the pandemic could surge again in the fall. What should schools do differently if there is another wave?
Yeah, so I know I'm really excited about some of the things that we have in place. I know Governor Evers and the Department of Health Services have announced that they're going to have COVID testing in schools, and so that's exciting. I think what we need to do is we need to ensure that we get the vaccines. I know that it's only right now for ages 12 and up, but we're going to have to probably continue with the other things like mask wearing and hand washing when we're in, you know, closer quarters. You know, for example, indoors in schools. And I think that's a small price to pay when we think about the benefits of face-to-face learning.
Jill Enderle is superintendent-elect of DPI, Department of Public Instruction, former superintendent of the Pecatonica Area School District. Join in. Are you happy with your child's public school in the pandemic? What do you want the head of the state's public education system to know? 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment for more State Cap on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Superintendent-elect of Public Instruction Jill Enderle with us. The legislature is set to vote this week on the $87.5 billion biennial budget crafted by Republicans. It falls billions short of what the governor called for in his budget proposal. So we're looking at the education piece of both spending plans, K-12 education, the biggest category of spending with state tax dollars. Jeff is joining us from Delafield. Hi, Jeff. What is on your mind?
Yes, good morning. Thank you. My question is regards to dollars per pupil and as it compared to different school districts. We're seeing the brunt of budget cuts in the Kettle Moraine School District. We've had a number of referendums, and we hear numbers thrown around that the state dollars per pupil are much higher in places like Brookfield. And my understanding is, and I could be wrong, please correct me, that the city of Milwaukee gets significantly more dollars per pupil already at our expense. And it's a little disappointing to me to hear how we're not investing enough constantly, but yet we see poor results from the city of Milwaukee. And my perception is that they get more dollars per student than most of the rest of us. So correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Jeff, thanks. Disparities in per pupil aid.
Yeah, it's fairly complicated. So July 1st this week, our estimated aid comes out from the state. It's the equalized aid formula, and every school district falls on that spectrum a little bit differently. The reason that Milwaukee may get more equalized aid from the state is because of higher poverty. And part of that calculation is property value per student, as well as enrollment. So so in Kettle Moraine, for example, there's, you know, higher property value, for example, probably fewer kids when you think about proportionate to the wealth. 1993, I don't want to get too in the weeds, but that's when revenue caps were put in place. And so school districts generally would be able to go to the taxpayers and say, this is how much we need to meet our budget this year. And wherever you were frozen in that place in 93 when those revenue limits were installed. And so Milwaukee was a low revenue spending district. Some other districts were higher. And so that disparity, I guess, or that inequity has just kind of compounded over time. But it is based on poverty. Quite much of it is based on poverty and property value wealth.
And meanwhile, you know, we've seen school districts increasingly rely on referendums to pay for everything from new buildings to teacher raises. What changes would you like to see to how we fund schools and how per pupil is looked at for funding?
Yeah, I think when we think about school referendum, I mean, just like the caller said, I mean, it's not our imagination. I mean, we have been going to referendum more frequently. There is a correlation between having to go to referendum and, you know, of course, local tax increases. I mean, what we're doing is we're taxing ourselves locally because of the decline in state funding to our school districts. If the state kept up its promise of 2/3 funding, which was under Governor Thompson, I mean, we would see fewer local school districts have to raise their own taxes. And when the state does not invest, local communities have to decide for themselves if they want to invest. And of course, at the end of the day, not all referendums are successful, and that further widens our gaps.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How often do you see that these referendums get through? And when they don't get through, do districts come right back or do they wait?
I think it's going to depend. You know, we've been seeing a higher passing rate of referendum in the past 6 years, I want to say it's been. And part of it is frequency. I mean, yeah, we've been having to go more frequently because of the, you know, not getting what we were promised generally from the state of Wisconsin. But costs have gone up. And so by doing these tax cuts, and I kind of put that in air quotes, you know, for those of you on the air, by doing these tax cuts, the legislature is essentially kicking the, you know, the can to the local school boards to make them decide if they're going to raise taxes. So either way, we have to function. Schools are not cheap. I mean, we have to pay for personnel. We have to pay for facilities. I mean, when you look at utility rates and transportation, all that stuff goes up in cost every year. And when the state isn't giving us a cost of living increase, somebody's got to make up the difference. And unfortunately, it's the local taxpayers. And again, if a school district doesn't pass the referendum, they have to make cuts. Often they're able to go back, you know, maybe not the next election, but the following election for another referendum. And that helps, of course, you know, help them meet their budget. But when you look at, you know, the state of Wisconsin, they need to be meeting their obligation to our local school districts.
I want to look inward for a moment at DPI. You know, DPI has been criticized for being too bureaucratic. And in recent years, there have been calls for public instruction to restructure itself, to direct more resources and decision-making ability to local school boards and to teachers. Are you planning to make structural changes in how DPI is run?
You know, I actually don't agree with that assessment, honestly. DPI... that's their job. You know, they are to manage school funding and grants and federal dollars and, you know, enforce guidance and things. And I think the local school boards have a lot of authority. It's you know, when you look at curriculum, when you look at setting budgets and spending and hiring and all these other pieces, locals, there's a lot of local control. And I think DPI has been a good partner in supporting that.
Jill Enderle is with us, superintendent-elect of public instruction for Wisconsin. She takes office on July 5th. You can join in. Do you have a child with special needs? What school services does your family rely on? And what more would you like schools to do to help your child? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tom is joining us from Marinette. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I would just like to say the answer isn't always spending another $1 billion. My dad worked for the school for 35 years ahead of maintenance, and it was so sad when he retired. You go down to the dump, and there's a whole mountain of desks and chairs and tables down there that they threw away, and I know that's just a small portion. And also, my wife teaches school right now currently, and they just did a, I don't know the exact number, $16 million renovation. And the superintendent, in my opinion, didn't or doesn't have knowledge of building. So he wasted, and I'm a contractor, just small time. I don't know nothing about building commercial buildings. But in my opinion, he wasted $1 million or more because he didn't know what he was doing.
Tom, you're cutting out there. I want Jill Enderle to respond, though.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's always going to be concerns that, you know, would be best addressed by a local school board. And I think that those are some of those right there.
Looking at the students who fell behind in the pandemic, school, summer school is underway. There are a lot of concerns about children's education. And as we have heard, in remote learning, what are your plans to make sure students get back on track in the fall?
Yeah, you know, it's like when we look at, you know, there are so many things that we could be doing that I do feel have been put in jeopardy because of the lack of funding, you know, that the state is giving its schools. I mean, when you look at after school programming, those are proven programs. You look at early childhood programming, you look at enrichment. We know that these are the kinds of things that kids need. I mean, then there's, of course, the infrastructure pieces. We look at broadband, and we look at rural Wisconsin, and we look at all the opportunities that we could have as a state in not just educational growth in our public schools and libraries, but in business and commerce. And, you know, we have to really start considering that schools, public schools, libraries are part of infrastructure just as, you know, utilities are as well.
In the last couple seconds here, as you take office, what is your top priority? What will you tackle first?
Oh, gosh, there's a lot of needs, right? But the biggest one is going to be making sure that we get a budget that closes the gaps for our kids, making sure that we have a plan that'll help school districts help their kids and their families recover from this pandemic.
Jill Enderle, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. It was a pleasure.
Jill Enderle is superintendent-elect for the Wisconsin Department of Instruction. She takes office a week from today. Just ahead, we talk with a community garden coordinator about how you can keep your gardens healthy during the heat of the summer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.